So what I wanted to
is check whether I've, yeah, I did turn the recorder on.
Is I wanted to take the topic and then say some, and then introduce you to some of my ways of thinking, not tell you how I think you should answer that question. And preliminaries is that, the subtitle of a book I had published a few years ago, Unruly Complexity, is Ecology, Interpretation, Engagement. So there's the science, the interpretation of the science, and then trying to engage with changing those things. And that's characteristic of my work. I'm not an average SDS person because my PhD is in science. I still try to make contributions to science. To the extent that I've done historical and sociological work interpreting science in its social context, I've always thought, I want these interpretations to A, satisfy my standards of, as a scientist, of explanation, but B, correspond enough with what it feels like to be a scientist that the interpretations might help you engage with the changing of science, and particularly the changing of science as it affects its social context. So this first link, the science to interpretation, I often do around this what I call reciprocal animation, which is borrowing from the philosopher Max Black when he's writing about metaphors, but it doesn't really matter. But the basic idea is that close examination of the science can lead you to questions about interpreting its social context. You know, why do people pursue those ideas, accept that knowledge, and so on? But going into the reciprocal part of it is going into the social context can expose questions that the scientists haven't really dealt with very well. So the scientist in me finds the STS part quite productive. I didn't like that.
So maybe it's just, I think it's going to sleep, maybe. And it's not reading it once it's asleep. Is that it?
It was doing this before. I thought, oh, that's good. So it's not wasting.
I'm a total jinx on machines today. I had a copier that I kept doing the weirdest things. I have a little force field around
it. It's not because your thing is running out of battery, is it?
No,
okay.
And I can,
so
I have a battery.
This second link from interpretation engagement, one of the things that I was, I found myself doing as an interpreter, learning history of science and so on, was that the themes people were using were too big for me. They wanted to say someone's science is governed by the metaphors they use. It was like too big in the sense of metaphors into science. My experience of being a scientist was there were a lot more diverse practical considerations. And if someone interested in moving science in a different direction, I would think there are many different points of trying to engage and change the science. You know, there's no master switch, there's no sort of metaphor. We don't need to change our heads to a different metaphor. We need to pay attention to the many different practical considerations. So that's a heterogeneous part of it. And the construction part of it, you know, a lot of people say, I'm not a social constructivist. But I actually think construction is a great word. Construction is a very, like, material word, building out of bricks and mortar and different components. And construction is, all, to me, if you take it in its in that construal, it's a nice word. So construction here connotes many diverse elements linked together over time. So there's a process, and often I call those intersecting processes. Things have multiple contributing causes, so there are multiple points of engagement. So that's my kind of SDS theory. And the next slide, nothing happened. So what did I do wrong?
It's blank.
You know, there's a point where I pulled out the flash drive and then put it back in again, so I think what it's doing is telling me it didn't have the thing in its buffer. So I'm going to just open it again. Make it wrong. Oh, look, these are just a schematic of, and it was nice because I studied, there was this Sudan Sahel And so in my analysis of the project, what happened at MIT, everything, this was before the status center, so everything is rectangular in this picture of MIT. That this is much bigger, and the pastoralists, they spent 3 weeks in Africa, is small in this picture. But the actual analysis involved a lot of detail about what kind of computer compilers, and you know, length of time in the field, and their metaphors, and so on. So that's just an image of it. But another image of this construction out of many components, this isn't my work, this is Bowlby's, who was a developmental psychologist, analysis of, reanalysis or presentation of some work by medical sociologist George Brown, where George Brown was trying to understand the incidence of, the high incidence of clinical depression among working class women in an area of London in the late 1960s. And he found that, yes, you're more likely to have had a severe event in the recent year, but these events were more likely if they had chronically difficult living conditions, which you're more likely to have if you're working class. They're also more likely, the severe event was more likely to contribute to hopeless depression if there was an unsupported partner or a lack of partner, which in their analysis was more likely to have happened in early partnerships and early pregnancies. So for some of these were sort of the adult factors, but they also found that there was a loss of the primary caregiver or the mother before age 11 was statistically significantly related to this. And so Bowlby kind of puts it into this overall picture. Loss of mother and lack of care, particularly if you're working class, means you're more likely as a teenage girl to be institutionalized. And one way to get out of that situation is to get into an early relationship, which are more likely to break up. So all these things are dotted because they're not deterministic, they're statistical. So this kind of lots of different components, in this case, Bowlby separates them out into psychology, family, and class, add up over time to explain the outcome. So, and if we wanted to change these outcomes, in my teaching, I would add a hypothetical genetic strand, and I would say, so where should we intervene? So knowing the genetics is not necessarily going to be especially effective, or it's not going to be any more effective. Even if you said that's the root cause of some of the depressions, it's not going to be any more effective than perhaps social workers at hospitals watching if a mother dies in the hospital to make sure that there's some people spring into action so that the children aren't so vulnerable in that situation. Making institutions of custodial institutions of more humane places. These stars are about improving the social welfare for working class, so they're not so likely to have difficult living conditions. And Brown's co-worker, Tyrrell Harris, has trained as a therapist, and she's actually done some work trying to prophylactically create friending networks, so people are more likely to have a circle of friends in this area of London. Not saying we know which person's going to have the severe event, but just having those people to talk to when something happens. So anyway, so that's another case of multiple components building up over time, giving you multiple points of engagement. Now, none of those points of engagement are going to solve the problem on its own. You know, you could spend your whole life trying to improve welfare policies, and you wouldn't necessarily eliminate this, because there are these other levels at which contribute to these. Okay, so that was the preamble. I guess I got to be quick then. Science. Oh, so this is a scientist in me relating to this topic. That there's a significant scientific issue which is not well recognized. It's unacknowledged or under-acknowledged. So this is a bold claim. Let me see if I can explain what I think this issue is. So this is a scientist in me saying, if I probe into a scientific issue, it opens up to me thinking about the social context, which may be in part the social dynamics of the scientific fields. So this underlying heterogeneity. So in genetics, we, in studies of heredity, people talk about heritability. They say, you know, human height is like 90% heritable. Now they're not saying, even though people throw around that term, they're not talking about a Huntington's chorea gene, they're talking about something about similarity between parents and offspring in their height. And the way they'll study it, a typical way with humans, is you'll look at dizygotic twins, which are fraternal twins, and monozygotic twins, which are identical twins. And these curly brackets in this diagram are saying dizygotic twins tend to be similar in their, let's say, height, but they tend to be less similar than the monozygotic twins. So identical twins tend to be more similar than the dizygotic twins. And so you see that's a lot of twin pairs in this diagram. Household one, household two, twin pair. And so the heritability is a measure, there's formulas and so on, which tells you how much, depends on how much bigger, how much less similar the dizygotic twins are compared to the monozygotic twins. So, you know, if that curly bracket was really small and that was really big, there'd be a bigger heritability. Now, I'm very prepared to say that the reason these monozygote twins are very similar is because they share all their genes. They do share all their genes. And the reasons these are less similar is they share fewer of their genes. But the thing that's not well acknowledged is there's nothing in that analysis which says that the genes that this monozygotic twin pair share, let's say, you know, in genetics we have pairs of genes, so they're delayed, little b, big c, and so on. And we have environmental conditions growing up in these different households. There's nothing to say that the genes that made these ones similar are the same genes that made this one similar. That underlying genetics and environmental factors could be heterogeneous in this whole population. There's nothing to say that this sequence for this pair is going to be the same sequence for that pair. Now that might seem a bit weird if you think, well, Huntington's chorea, you have two families and they have Huntington's disease, so surely it's parsimonious to think they have the same genes. Yeah, but that's a simple case of a change just in one place in your genome. But most of the things that get argued about, like height or IQ test scores or something like that, aren't related to any simple, single change on the genome. People are assuming the very fact that they're studying height and not the genes, it's because they don't know what the genes are, and they're assuming there are many of them involved, and sometimes they even concede that there are many environmental factors. But this underlying heterogeneity is not discussed in the literature. And my attempts to, I've got various things published on it, but I've also got various rejections which are interesting in itself. But just to accentuate my point, so you might believe that maybe I have a scientific point, is that I could get these data on the dizygotic twins, the monozygotic twins, and so on. I could analyze them, I could show that there's a high heritability for, you know, tip of your body to tip of your body. You say, oh yeah, so the heritability of this thing is 90%. And then I could come back and tell you, but these dizygotic twins are snakes. And this is a sorghum plant. And this is a human. And this is, there is nothing in the method of analysis which says these things have to be in the same species. You might say, well, why would you ever do the analysis? Well, the method doesn't require any knowledge of this being the same in the same species. And clearly, if this was a plant, and this was a snake, and this was a plant, you wouldn't expect that the underlying genes are the same that are affecting their body. So you might say, yeah, well, if they're in the same order, the same genus, the same, would you start to suspect that the underlying genes? And I say, well, it's just an open question. We don't know. There's nothing in the method or the world that tells us they have to have the same genes. The reason these two got to be tall and a similar tall is because they had the same genes as these got to be. Okay, so that's a scientist in me. So what do I do with that as an STS person? I might look at this history. So how did these methods get developed in their time so that they kind of forgot that, or they didn't pay attention to it? And a lot of the history is that they get brought up in agriculture where you don't actually, you can do a lot of breeding. It doesn't matter. It's a lot of stuff that you can do in agriculture you can't do in humans. So then you have to say, well, how did the methods get transferred from agriculture to humans? So that's a, I could look into the history of it. Another thing that I've been thinking about doing, or in a way I am doing, is I submit for publication technical bits of this to particular scientific magazines. I get rid of all my critical science and society interpretations, and I watch the responses, and I'm cataloging. I mean, I'd like to get published, but I'm also very interested in the way people reject me. They will read in all sorts of social analyses which are just not in the article because they kind of, they know they're implied by it. So I'm working on this. But for this particular unit we're doing, I think there's this issue, an issue which I call the conflation of family and population. And this link, if you clicked on it, would get you to a series of blog posts, and they're called The Conflation of Family and Population Helps Explain Why the Nature-Nurture versus Nurture Formulation Persists. And so this is kind of an interpretive theme, it's very general, and I did two of them back in September, and then I wanted to finish with a third one, but I realized my ideas weren't very tight, but when we were doing this unit, I said, I've got to finish writing, and so today and tomorrow on my blog, it turned out to be third and fourth, is my analysis. I'm going to get back to this in a second. And then once I realized that people thinking about family, I'll explain what I mean by this, family and population are conflated, I then might go back to history again and to review the early eugenics. You know, people, just a brief introduction, in eugenics, people would talk about, and Galton, about the decline of the leading classes in England, or the decline of England versus other nations. They're very sensitive about it. They used to, in the 19th century, people used to talk about atavism a lot, you know, that things could be going well, but then there'd be this throwback. We ought to have Adriana here. She could tell us this about in literature. We don't talk about that much. It was a big issue in Darwin's discussions, atavism and so on. But this idea that somehow you could slip back, you'd made progress, you could slip back, was a big issue for the population as a whole, whether the population is the elites in England or England versus the rest of the world. But when it came down to what eugenic guides mostly said, they were mostly about good marriages, saying make sure you marry the right person. And when you think about it logically, okay, if the people reading this stuff marry correctly, that just means in the population of England as a whole, then the ones who aren't reading these guides are not marrying as well. But we've got the same mix of genes in the next generation. It just, you know, if it's like someone gets to marry well, then that means someone else didn't get to marry that person. But somehow people's concerns about families and what would happen if they married the wrong ways sort of got conflated with their concerns about England, the status of the what Worski calls the new professional middle class, in other people do call it in his article in England, and also England's status in the, I mean, we think of England as being one of these established places, but I guess people in the 19th century were still very aware that England was quite a new world power. Okay, so we'd go back to the history. Now let me just sort of try to say something about the conflation, what I think about the conflation. Oh no, okay. I will say it in a second. But so there's a third level. The third level is engagements. What do you do once you have this interpretation? And in my current book project, which hasn't made all that much progress this year, I tried to, it's called Troubled by Heterogeneity. I said at the beginning of this semester that heterogeneity was an issue for me. And I've got like 8 cases that I've been working on. And what I want to write about them, I want to write about them with different frames. And the third frame is what I call these participatory postscripts. So what I want to write about it is in a way that says, don't rely on the author to have the analysis, to have the answer of these issues. I want to try and, you know, pull the dialogue out of the pages of the book. And so part of what I want to write about in the book is my attempts to pull it out. And so one of them that I plan is to have, part of why I started working on blogs is I wanted to get that stand-up medium. So I want to juxtapose two types of entries in this blog. Stories shared by family members, caregivers, and other actors, including STS researchers, that amplify the PKU picture. Okay, so PKU is phenylketonuria, and it's this, it was one of the first things you got screened for, newborns got screened for, and it really started in Massachusetts in the 1960s. And so everyone, I think, in the United States gets, their kids get screened for PKU. And if you shown to have phenylketonuria, you can go on a special diet, and it's the poster child of, if you know the genetics, you can do something to make sure people aren't affected by it. But when you actually look at what happens with someone who has the diagnosis of PKU, it's both incredibly complicated in their lifetime to support them, insurance coverage, all these things. And the way this screening process got instituted over historical time was also all sorts of factors, including Kennedy's sister being retarded in some way, so his family really hoping there would be a biological solution. Anyway, there's a lot of this heterogeneous construction, these intersecting processes in PKU in an individual's lifetime and PKU in terms of its development of the science and its applications. So, okay, diverse pictures, diverse pathways to development over the life course for those with distinct genetic conditions. So I want to try to get stories of those. And I also, and the flip side of that is that all these people, like Craig Venter, who's his group raced with the public group to decode the genome, and all these claims that once we have this information, we'll be able to reshape human life. There are all these forums. There's this thing called Edge. It's like TED that where people get to give their particularly guys get to give their fantasies of who they are.
Sometimes
there are women go to TED, but not so often. So readers would invite to contribute these, and they would play off each other and make comments and so on. So we would think about that. The details aren't so important, but that's my attempt. You know, I'm an academic, but attempt to use the fact that I can think about the science and think about the science in its social context to create an engagement. Let me just say for a couple of minutes what I think this family, see if I can say what this family population conflation is. Well, I already said it around the eugenics case, but if I go back to this thing. So in a particular family, we live in this world or this world. We live in one of these places, and we notice that our non-adopted kids, if we have non-adopted kids, are kind of resemble us in a way. And we notice it about other families. We don't have to have had those kids. We notice it about ourselves and our parents. And so we notice that we notice a lot of differences from our parents too, but you know, when someone says, but have you looked at your pictures of you at 15 and your father at 15? And it's like, oh, was I really like him? And other stuff comes up. So we notice that all the time. But somehow we're thinking that that also tells us about the way is going to help us understand the way we get differences in the world as a whole. By thinking about these similarities in the family, we're going to get some understanding of the similarities and variations in the population as a whole. Where people are, you know, when people say there's we're looking for a gene for X, we're looking for a gene for fit height, they've got a sense it's going to be possible from noticing that, you know, I shared half my genes with my father and I share my height and with him, and so we could find one. But if we're thinking about populations as a whole, we're thinking about the genes we find for height, they're going to be the same across the whole population. And there's nothing in this analysis which says they have to be. And it's not surprising that they had very little success finding these genes. There's this thing called the genome-wide association studies, which are just incredible the way huge data sets, and they get huge funding, and they're able to like identify at many, many different places on the genome how having this variant will increase your risk of diabetes by 1.3%, and it's statistically significant. But it's such small amounts, they're not finding what they hoped, which was like finding genes like the phenylketonuria genes that would then allow you to say, okay, so that's how diabetes occurs, and we've now got to investigate those biochemical pathways and find some drugs that can intervene and so on. They're not finding them. And there's a whole kind of, the last 6 months, 9 months, there's all sorts of editorials saying, why didn't we think it would, or we were fooled, or why do we have so much confidence? And so the rise and fall of genome-wide associations happened in the last 5 years. And I think part of it is they just didn't pay attention to the possibility of underlying heterogeneity. And me trying to understand why they didn't, I have to think, because it's such an obvious conceptual point to me, is I have to think about the social context. And there I start to think about the way people are so concerned. You know, like this guy Stern, he wanted not just to pass on his genes, he wanted to pass on his social attributes. So the framing of heredity as something where you pass on something conflates the environmental and the genetic side of social, but it makes social something you control within a family where most of us feel not very empowered to control the way society as a whole. So that's my quick introduction to this idea of conflation of family and society. So that's an introduction to my kind of thinking, this like these three-way interactions around this particular topic. And it will be quite different from the way Sally thinks about it. And that will be, and it'll be quite different from the way Anne Pastor Sterling presented it 2 years ago. And so these are just points on that. And you're quite welcome to ask questions, but we
probably... It's 5:51.
Yeah, so...
One of the things, just on some of this, the heterogeneity issue, I find when I talk sometimes about skin color, when I say there is no race gene, there's nothing, you know, two people of the same race didn't have anything in common, people always look at me and go, yeah, right, because they have this assumption that there's gene sequences that will be responsible for skin color. Mm-hmm. And it's not true. I mean, you can have people with the same sequence and have very different skin colors, or because of their environment or other factors, and many, many different things that contribute to it, and that you and I can have exactly the same, I mean, you can get exactly the same skin color but not have the any sequence that is responsible for those. And so that's a nice example of this heterogeneity, you know, that within you get this idea that, well, skin color, there's something gotta be heritable about it, because after all, look, black people have black children, white people have white children, but it's really not like that.
This underlying heterogeneity idea, I'm not saying it's a fact that every trait you can think of has underlying heterogeneity. I just say in my work, I always say there's the possibility of it, and the method doesn't allow you to rule it out. Or if the method doesn't allow you to rule it out, then what can you do with this knowledge? And mostly what you can do with it is within families. You can say, oh, okay, so my sibling got diabetes 1, which is, which is the one that you get
a
childhood, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And so that means I'm more likely to get it, so I better start, even before I get it, I better start doing something about it. So within families, you might be able to use that knowledge. But it could be that the particular way I got diabetes, or my sibling got diabetes 1, is different from the way someone else gets it. And it's also, there must be some underlying heterogeneity in that, because if we were, let's say my identical twins got it, because if that one's got it before me, then there must be other factors influencing it. So, and why the scientists haven't paid attention to it is, well, one possibility is that I'm wrong, and you know, they've all thought about it and so on. But there are, in my work, I pick up on these things and I
probe them to think about the social context.